pig's head is a pig's head. And a Jew is a Jew, and 'tis against their religion, and I don't blame them. The butcher says, "Are you a bit of an expert, missus, on the Jews and the pig?" "I am not," says ma'am. "But there was a Jewish woman, Mrs. Leibowitz, in New York, and I don't know what we would have done without her." The butcher takes the pig's head off a shelf, and when Maliki says, "Ooh, ooh, look at the dead dog," the butcher and ma'am burst out laughing. He wraps the head in a newspaper, hands it to ma'am, and says, "Happy Christmas." Then he wraps up some sausages and tells her, "Take these sausages for your breakfast on Christmas Day." Ma'am says, "Oh, I can't afford sausages." And he says, "Am I asking you for money? Am I? Take these sausages. They might help make up for the lack of a goose or a ham." "Sure you don't have to do that," says ma'am. "I know that, missus. If I had to do it, I wouldn't." Ma'am says she has a pain in her back, that I'll have to carry the pig's head. I hold it against my chest, but it's damp, and when the newspaper begins to fall away, everyone can see the head. Ma'am says, "I'm ashamed in me life that the world should know we're having pig's head for Christmas. Boys from Leamy's National School see me, and they point and laugh. Oh, God, look at Frankie McCourtney's pig snout. Is that what the Yanks ate for Christmas dinner, Frankie?" One calls to another, "Hey, Christy, do you know how to eat a pig's head?" "No, I don't, Paddy." "Grab him by the ears and chew the face off of him." And Christy says, "Hi, Paddy, do you know the only part of the pig the McCourts don't eat?" "No, I don't, Christy. The only part they don't eat is the oink." After a few streets, the newspaper is gone altogether, and everyone can see the pig's head. His nose is flat against my chest and pointing up at my chin, and I feel sorry for him because he's dead and the world is laughing at him. My sister and two brothers are dead too. But if anyone laughed at them, I'd hit them with a rock. I wish Dad would come and help us because Mam has to stop every few steps and lean against the wall. She's holding her back and telling us she'll never be able to climb Barrack Hill. Even if Dad came, he wouldn't be much use because he never carries anything, parcels, bags, packages. If you carry such things, you lose your dignity. That's what he says. He carried the twins when they were tired, and he carried the Pope. But that was not the same as carrying ordinary things like a pig's head. He tells Maliki and me that when you grow up, you have to wear a collar and tie and never let people see you carry things. He's upstairs, sitting by the fire, smoking a cigarette, reading the Irish Press, which he loves because it's De Valera's paper, and he thinks De Valera is the greatest man in the world. He looks at me and the pig's head and tells ma'am it's a disgraceful thing to let a boy carry an object like that through the streets of Limerick. She takes off her coat and eases herself into the bed and tells him that next Christmas he can go out and find the dinner. She's worn out and gasping for a cup of tea, so would he drop his grand airs, boil the water for the tea and fry some bread before his two small sons starve to death. On Christmas morning, he lights the fire early so that we can have sausages and bread and tea. Mam sends me to Grandma to see if we can borrow a pot for the pig's head. Grandma says, "What are you having for your dinner?" "Pig's head. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, that's gone beyond the beyonds. Couldn't your father get out and find a ham, or a goose at least? What kind of man is he at all, at all?" Mam puts the head in the pot, just covered with water, and while the pig is boiling away, Dad takes Maliki and me to Mass at the Redemptorist Church. It's warm in the church and sweet with flowers and incense and candles. He takes us to see the baby Jesus in the crib. He's a big fat baby with fair curls like Maliki. Dad tells us that's Jesus' mother there, Mary, in the blue dress, and his father, St. Joseph, the old man with the beard. He says they're sad because they know Jesus will grow up and be killed so that we can all go to heaven. I ask why the baby Jesus has to die, and Dad says, "You can't ask questions like that." Maliki says, "Why?" And Dad tells him, "Be quiet." Ma'am is in a terrible state at home. There isn't enough coal to cook the dinner. The water isn't boiling anymore, and she says she's demented with worry. We'll have to go down the dock road again to see if there's any coal or turf lying around from the lorries. Surely we'll find something on the road this day of all days. Even the poorest of the poor don't go out on Christmas Day picking coal off the road. There's no use asking Dad to go, because he will never stoop that low. And even if he did, he won't carry things through the streets. It's a rule he has. Ma'am can't go because of the pain in her back. She says, "You'll have to go, Frank, and take Maliki with you." It's a long way to the dock road, but we don't mind because our bellies are filled with sausages and bread, and it's not raining. We carry a canvas bag Ma'am borrowed from Mrs. Hannon next door, and Ma'am is right, there's no one on the dock road. The poor are all at home having pig's head, or maybe a goose, and we have the dock road to ourselves. We find bits of coal and turf stuck in cracks in the road and in the walls of the coal yards. We find bits of paper and cardboard that would be useful in starting the fire again. We're wandering around trying to fill the bag when Pat Keating comes along. He must have washed himself for Christmas because he's not as black as he was when Eugene died. He wants to know what we're doing with that bag, and when Maliki tells him, he says, "Jesus, Mary and Holy St. Joseph, Christmas Day and ye don't have a fire for your pig's head. That's a bloody disgrace." He takes us to South's pub, which is not supposed to be open, but he's a regular customer, and there's a back door for men who want their pint to celebrate the birthday of the baby Jesus above in the crib. He orders his pint and lemonade for us, and asks the man if there's any chance of getting a few lumps of coal. The man says he's been serving drink for 27 years, and nobody ever asked him for coal before. Pa says it would be a favour, and the man says if Pa asked for the moon, he'd fly up and bring it back. The man leads us to the coal hole under the stairs and tells us take what we can carry. It's real coal and not bits from the dock road, and if we can't carry it, we can drag it along the ground. It takes us a long time to go from South Pub to Barrack Hill because of a hole in the bag. I pull the bag, and it's Maliki's job to pick up the lumps that fall through the hole and put them back again. Then it starts to rain, and we can't stand in the doorway till it passes because we have that coal, and it's leaving a black trail along the pavement, and Maliki is turning black from picking up the lumps, pushing them into the bag, and wiping the rain from his face with his wet black hands. I tell him he's black, he tells me I'm black, and a woman in a shop tells us, "Get away from that door, 'tis Christmas Day," and she doesn't want to be looking at Africa. We have to keep dragging the bag, or we'll never have our Christmas dinner. It will take ages to get a fire going, and ages more to get our dinner, because the water has to be boiling when Ma'am puts in the head of cabbage and the potatoes, to keep the pig company in the pot. We drag the bag up O'Connell Avenue, and we see people in their houses sitting around tables with all kinds of decorations and bright lights. At one house, they push up the window, and the children point and laugh and call to us, "Look at the Zulus! Where are your spears?" Maliki makes faces at them and wants to throw coal at them, but I tell him if he throws coal, there's less for the pig and we'll never get our dinner. The downstairs in our house is a lake again from the rain pouring under the door, but it doesn't matter because we're drenched anyway and we can wade through the water. Dad comes down and drags the bag upstairs to Italy. He says we're good boys for getting so much coal, that the dock road must have been covered with it. When Ma'am sees us, she starts to laugh. Then she cries. She's laughing because we're so black, and crying because we're sopping wet. She tells us, "Take off all our clothes," and she washes the coal off our hands and faces. She tells Dad the pig's head can wait a while, so that we can have a jam jar of hot tea. It's raining outside, and there's a lake downstairs in our kitchen. But up here in Italy, the fire is going again, and the room is so dry and warm that after our tea, Maliki and I doze off in the bed, and we don't wake till Dad tells us the dinner is ready. Our clothes are still wet, so Maliki sits in the trunk at the table, wrapped in Mam's red American overcoat, and I'm wrapped in an old coat that Mam's father left behind when he went to Australia. There are delicious smells in the room, cabbage, potatoes and the pig's head. But when Dad lifts the head from the pot to a plate, Maliki says, "Oh, the poor pig. I don't want to eat the poor pig." Mam says, "If you were hungry, you'd eat it. Now stop the nonsense and eat your dinner." Dad says, "Wait a minute." He takes slices from the two cheeks, places them on our plates and smears them with mustard. He takes the plate that holds the pig's head and puts it on the floor under the table. "Now," he says to Maliki, "that's ham." And Maliki eats it because he's not looking at what it came from, and it isn't pig's head anymore. The cabbage is soft and hot, and there are plenty of potatoes with butter and salt. Mam peels our potatoes, but Dad eats his, skin and all. He says all the nourishment of a potato is in the skin. And Mam says it's a good thing he's not eating eggs. He'd be chewing the shells and all. He says he would. And it's a disgrace that the Irish throw out millions of potato skins every day, and that's why thousands are dying of consumption. And surely there's nourishment in the shell of an egg, since waste is the eighth deadly sin. If he had his way, and Mam says, "Never mind your way, eat your dinner." He eats half a potato with its skin on and puts the other half back in the pot. He eats a small slice of the pig's cheek and a leaf of cabbage and leaves the rest on his plate for Maliki and me. He makes more tea, and we have that with bread and jam, so that no one can say we didn't have a sweet on Christmas Day. It's dark now and still raining outside, and the coal is glowing in the grate where Mam and Dad sit and smoke their cigarettes. There's nothing to do when your clothes are wet, but get back into bed where it's cozy. And your father can tell you a story about how Cuchulainn became a Catholic, and you fall asleep and dream about the pig standing in the crib at the Redemptorist Church crying because he and the baby Jesus and Cuchulainn all have to grow up and die. The angel that brought Margaret and the twins comes again and brings us another brother, Michael. Dad says he found Michael on the seventh step of the stairs to Italy. He says that's what you have to watch for when you ask for a new baby, the angel on the seventh step. Maliki wants to know how you can get a new brother from the angel on the seventh step if you don't have any stairs in your house, and Dad tells him that asking too many questions is an affliction. Maliki wants to know what an affliction is. Affliction. I'd like to know what that word means. Affliction. But Dad says, "Ach, child, the world is an affliction and everything in it." Puts on his cap and goes to the Bedford Row Hospital to see Mam and Michael. She's in the hospital with the pain in her back, and she has the baby with her to make sure he was healthy when he was left on the seventh step. I don't understand this because I'm sure angels would never leave a sick baby on the seventh step. There's no use asking Dad or Mam about this. They say, "You're getting as bad as your brother for asking questions. Go play." I know that big people don't like questions from children. They can ask all the questions they like. "How's school? Are you a good boy? Did you say your prayers?" But if you ask them, did they say their prayers, you might be hit in the head. Dad brings Mam home with the new baby, and she has to stay in bed for a few days with the pain in her back. She says this baby is the spitting image of our sister who died, with his wavy black hair, his lovely blue eyes, and the gorgeous eyebrows. That's what Mam says. I want to know if the baby will be spitting. I also want to know which is the seventh step, because there are nine steps on the stairs. And I'd like to know if you count from the bottom or the top. Dad doesn't mind answering this question. Angels come down from above, he says, and not up from kitchens like ours, which are lakes from October till April. So, I find the seventh step by counting from the top. The baby Michael has a cold. His head is stuffed and he can barely breathe. Mam worries because it's Sunday and the dispensary for the poor is closed. If you go to the doctor's house and the maid sees you from the lower classes, she tells you, "Go to the dispensary where you belong." If you tell her the child is dying in your arms, she'll say, "The doctor is in the country riding his horse." Man cries because the baby is struggling to get air through his mouth. She tries to clear his nostrils with a bit of rolled up paper, but she's afraid to push it too far up. Dad says, "There's no need for that. You're not supposed to be pushing things inside a child's head." It looks like he's going to kiss the baby. Instead, he has his mouth on the little nose, and he's sucking the bad stuff out of Michael's head. He spits it into the fire. Michael gives out a loud cry, and you can see him drawing the air into his head and kicking his legs and laughing. Mam looks at Dad as if he just came down from heaven. And Dad says, "That's what we did in Antrim long before there were doctors riding their horses." Michael entitles us to a few extra shillings on the dole, but Mam says it isn't enough. Now she has to go to the St. Vincent de Paul Society for food. One night there's a knock on the door, and Mam sends me down to see who it is. There are two men from the St. Vincent de Paul, and they want to see my mother and father. I tell them my parents are upstairs in Italy, and they say, "What? Upstairs where 'tis dry. I'll tell them." They want to know what that little shed is beside our front door. I tell them it's the lavatory. They want to know why it isn't in the back of the house, and I tell them it's the lavatory for the whole lane, and it's a good thing it's not in the back of our house, or we'd have people traipsing through our kitchen with buckets that would make you sick. They say, "Are you sure there's one lavatory for the whole lane?" I am. They say, "Mother of God." Mam calls down from Italy, "Who's down there?" "The men." "What men?" "From the St. Vincent de Paul." They're careful the way they step into the lake in the kitchen, and they make tisk-tisk and tut-tut noises, and they tell one another, "Isn't this a disgrace?" till they get upstairs to Italy. They tell Mam and Dad they're sorry to disturb them, but the society has to be sure they're helping deserving cases. Mam offers them a cup of tea, but they look around and say, "No, thank you." They want to know why we're living upstairs. They want to know about the lavatory. They ask questions because big people can ask all the questions they like and write in notebooks, especially when they're wearing collars and ties and suits. They ask how old Michael is, how much Dad gets at the labour exchange, when did he last have a job, why doesn't he have a job now, and what class of an accent is that he has. Dad tells them the lavatory could kill us with every class of disease, that the kitchen floods in the winter and we have to move upstairs to stay dry. He says the River Shannon is responsible for all the dampness in the world and killing us one by one. Maliki tells them we're living in Italy, and they smile. Mam asks if there's any chance of getting boots for Maliki and me, and they say she'll have to come down to Osnam House and apply. She says she hasn't been feeling well since the baby came, and she wouldn't be able to stand in a long queue. But they say everyone has to be treated the same. Even a woman down in the Irish town that had triplets, and thank you, we'll make our report to the society. When they're leaving, Maliki wants to show them where the angel left Michael on the seventh step, but Dad tells him, "Not now, not now." Maliki cries, and one of the men gives him a piece of toffee from his pocket, and I wish I had something to cry about so that I get a piece too. I have to go downstairs again and show the men where to step to keep their feet dry. They keep shaking their heads and saying, "God Almighty and Mother of God, this is desperate. That's not Italy they have upstairs, that's Calcutta." Dad is telling Mam up in Italy she should never beg like that. "What do you mean, beg? Don't you have any pride begging for boots like that? And what would you do, Mr. Grandmanner? Would you let them go barefoot?" "I'd rather fix the shoes they have. The shoes they have are falling to pieces. I can fix them," he says. "You can't fix anything. You're useless," she says. He comes home the next day with an old bicycle tire. He sends me to Mr. Hannon next door for the loan of a last and a hammer. He takes Mam's sharp knife, and he hacks at the tire till he has pieces to fit on the soles and heels of our shoes. Mam tells him he's going to destroy the shoes altogether, but he pounds away with the hammer, driving the nails through the rubber pieces and into the shoes. Mam says, God above, if you left the shoes alone, they'd last till Easter at least, and we might get the boots from the St. Vincent de Paul. But he won't stop till the soles and heels are covered with squares of rubber tire, which stick out on each side of the shoe and flop before and behind. He makes us put on the shoes and tells us our feet will be good and warm, but we don't want to wear them anymore because the tire pieces are so lumpy we stumble when we walk around Italy. He sends me back to Mr. Hannon with the last and hammer, and Mrs. Hannon says, God above, what's up with your shoes? She laughs, and Mr. Hannon shakes his head, and I feel ashamed. I don't want to go to school next day, and I pretend to be sick, but Dad gets us up and gives us our fried bread and tea, and tells us we should be grateful we have any shoes at all, that there are boys in Leamy's National School who go to school barefoot on bitter days. On our way to school, Leamy's boys laugh at us, because the tire pieces are so thick, they add a few inches to our height, and the boys say, How's the air up there? There are 6 or 7 barefoot boys in my class, and they don't say anything, and I wonder if it's better to have shoes with rubber tires that make you trip and stumble, or to go barefoot. If you have no shoes at all, you'll have all the barefoot boys on your side. If you have rubber tires on your shoes, you're all alone with your brother, and you have to fight your own battles. I sit on a bench in the schoolyard shed and take off my shoes and stockings, but when I go into the class, the master wants to know where my shoes are. He knows I'm not one of the barefoot boys, and he makes me go back to the yard, bring in the shoes, and put them on. Then he says to the class, There is sneering here. There is jeering at the misfortunes of others. Is there anyone in this class that thinks he's perfect? Raise your hands.
There are no hands.
Is there anyone in this class that comes from a rich family with money galore to spend on shoes? Raise your hands.
There are no hands.
He says, There are boys here who have to mend their shoes whatever way they can. There are boys in this class with no shoes at all. It's not their fault, and it's no shame. Our Lord had no shoes. He died shoeless. Do you see him hanging on the cross, sporting shoes? Do you, boys? No, sir. What is it you don't see our Lord doing? Hanging on the cross and sporting shoes, sir. Now if I hear of one boy in this class jeering and sneering at McCourt or his brother over their shoes, the stick will come out. What will come out, boys? The stick, sir. The stick will sting, boys. The ash plant will whistle through the air. It will land on the backside of the boy that jeers, the boy that sneers. Where will it land, boys?
On the boy that jeers, sir.
And
the boy that sneers, sir.
The boys bother us no more, and we wear our shoes with the rubber tires the few weeks to Easter, when the St. Vincent de Paul Society gives us the gift of boots. If I have to get up in the middle of the night to pee in the bucket, I go to the top of the stairs and look down to see if the angel might be on the 7th step. Sometimes I'm sure there's a light there, and if everyone's asleep, I sit on the step in case the angel might be bringing another baby or just coming for a visit. I ask Mam if the angel just brings the babies and then forgets about them. She says, Of course not. The angel never forgets the babies and comes back to make sure the baby is happy. I could ask the angel all kinds of questions and I'm sure he'd answer, unless it's a girl angel. But I'm sure a girl angel would answer questions too. I never heard anyone say they didn't. I sit on the 7th step a long time, and I'm sure the angel is there. I tell him all the things you can't tell your mother or father for fear of being hit on the head, or told go out and play. I tell him all about school, and how I'm afraid of the master and his stick when he roars at us in Irish. And I still don't know what he's talking about because I came from America, and the other boys were learning Irish a year before me. I stay on the seventh step till it gets too cold, or Dad gets up and tells me, go back to bed. He's the one who told me the angel comes to the seventh step in the first place, and you'd think he'd know why I'm sitting there. I told him one night that I was waiting for the angel, and he said, ach now, Francis, you're a bit of a dreamer. I get back into bed, but I can hear him whisper to my mother. The poor wee lad was sitting on the stairs talking away to the angel. He laughs, and my mother laughs, and I think, isn't it curious the way big people laugh over the angel who brought them a new child? Before Easter, we move back downstairs to Ireland. Easter is better than Christmas, because the air is warmer, the walls are not dripping with the damp, and the kitchen isn't a lake anymore. And if we're up early, we might catch the sun slanting for a minute through the kitchen window. In fine weather, men sit outside smoking their cigarettes, if they have them, looking at the world and watching us play. Women stand with their arms folded, chatting. They don't sit because all they do is stay at home, take care of the children, clean the house and cook a bit, and the men need the chairs. The men sit because they're worn out from walking to the labour exchange every morning to sign for the dole, discussing the world's problems and wondering what to do with the rest of the day. Some stop at the bookie to study the form and place a shilling or two on a sure thing. Some spend hours in the Carnegie Library reading English and Irish newspapers. A man on the dole needs to keep up with things because all the other men on the dole are experts on what's going on in the world. A man on the dole must be ready in case another man on the dole brings up Hitler or Mussolini or the terrible state of the Chinese millions. A man on the dole goes home after a day with the bookie or the newspaper, and his wife will not begrudge him a few minutes with the ease and peace of his cigarette and his tea and time to sit in his chair and think of the world. Easter is better than Christmas because Dad takes us to the Redemptorist Church where all the priests wear white and sing. They're happy because our Lord is in heaven. I asked Dad if the baby in the crib is dead and he says, no, he was 33 when he died and there he is, hanging on the cross. I don't understand how he grew up so fast that he's hanging there with a hat made of thorns and blood everywhere dripping from his head, his hands, his feet, and a big hole near his belly. Dad says I'll understand when I grow up. He tells me that all the time now. And I want to be big like him so that I can understand everything. It must be lovely to wake up in the morning and understand everything. I wish I could be like all the big people in the church, standing and kneeling and praying and understanding everything. At the Mass, people go up to the altar and the priest puts something into their mouths. They come back to their seats with their heads down, their mouths moving. Maliki says he's hungry and he wants some too. Dad says, shush, that's Holy Communion, the body and blood of our Lord. But Dad, shush, it's a mystery. There's no use asking more questions. If you ask a question, they tell you, it's a mystery, you'll understand when you grow up. Be a good boy, ask your mother, ask your father, for the love of Jesus, leave me alone. Go out and play. Dad gets his first job in Limerick at the cement factory, and Mam is happy. She won't have to stand in the queue at the St. Vincent de Paul Society asking for clothes and boots for Maliki and me. She says it's not begging, it's charity. But Dad says it's begging and shameful. Mam says she can now pay off the few pounds she owes at Kathleen O'Connell's shop, and she can pay back what she owes her own mother. She hates to be under obligation to anyone, especially her own mother. The cement factory is miles outside Limerick, and that means Dad has to be out of the house by 6 in the morning. He doesn't mind because he's used to the long walks. The night before, Mam makes him a flask of tea, a sandwich, a hard-boiled egg. She feels sorry for him the way he has to walk 3 miles out and 3 miles back. A bicycle would be handy, but you'd have to be working a year for the price of it. Friday is payday, and Mam is out of the bed early, cleaning the house and singing. There isn't much to clean in the house. She sweeps the kitchen floor and the floor of Italy, upstairs. She washes the 4 jam jars we use for mugs. She says if Dad's job lasts, we'll get proper cups and maybe saucers, and someday, with the help of God and His blessed mother, we'll have sheets on the bed, and, if we save a long time, a blanket or two, instead of those old coats which people must have left behind during the Great Famine. She boils water and washes the rags that keep Michael from shitting all over the pram and the house itself. Oh, she says, we'll have a lovely tea when your pop brings home the wages tonight. Pop! She's in a good mood. Sirens and whistles go off all over the city when the men finish work at 5:30. Malachi and I are excited because we know that when your father works and brings home the wages, you get the Friday penny. We know this from other boys whose fathers work, and we know that after your tea, you can go to Kathleen O'Connell's shop and buy sweets. If your mother is in a good mood, she might even give you tuppence to go to the Lyric Cinema the next day to see a film with James Cagney. The men who work in factories and shops in the city are coming into the lanes to have their supper, wash themselves, and go to the pub. The women go to the films at the Coliseum or the Lyric Cinema. They buy sweets and wild Woodbine cigarettes. And if their husbands are working a long time, they treat themselves to boxes of Black Magic chocolates. They love the romance films, and they have a great time crying their eyes out when there's an unhappy ending, or a handsome lover goes away to be shot by Hindus and other non-Catholics. We have to wait a long time for Dad to walk the miles from the cement factory. We can't have our tea till he's home, and that's very hard, because you smell the cooking of other families in the lane. Mam says it's a good thing payday is Friday when you can't eat meat, because the smell of bacon or sausages in other houses would drive her out of her mind. We can still have bread and cheese and a nice jam jar of tea with lashings of milk and sugar, and what more do you want? The women are gone to the cinemas, the men are in the pubs, and still Dad isn't home. Mam says it's a long way to the cement factory, even if he is a fast walker. She says that, but her eyes are watery, and she's not singing anymore. She's sitting by the fire smoking a wild Woodbine she got on credit from Kathleen O'Connell. The fag is the only luxury she has, and she'll never forget Kathleen for her goodness. She doesn't know how long she can keep the water boiling in this kettle. There's no use making the tea till Dad gets home, because it'll be stewed, coddled, boiled, and unfit to drink. Malachi says he's hungry, and she gives him a piece of bread and cheese to keep him going. She says, "This job could be the saving of us. 'Tis hard enough for him to get a job with his northern accent, and if he loses this one, I don't know what we're going to do." The darkness is in the lane, and we have to light a candle. She has to give us our tea and bread and cheese, because we're so hungry we can't wait another minute. She sits at the table, eats a bit of bread and cheese, smokes her wild Woodbine. She goes to the door to see if Dad is coming down the lane, and she talks about the paydays when we search for him all over Brooklyn. She says, "Someday we'll all go back to America, and we'll have a nice warm place to live in a lavatory down the hall like the one in Classen Avenue, and not this filthy thing outside our door." The women are coming home from the cinemas, laughing, and the men singing from the pubs. Mam says there's no use waiting up any longer. If Dad stays in the pubs till closing time, there'll be nothing left from his wages, and we might as well go to bed. She lies in her bed with Michael in her arms. It's quiet in the lane, and I can hear her crying, even though she pulls an old coat over her face. And I can hear in the distance, my father. I know it's my father, because he's the only one in Limerick who sings the song from the north, "Roddy McCauley goes to die on the bridge of Toon today." He comes round the corner at the top of the lane and starts Kevin Barry. He sings a verse, stops, holds onto a wall, cries over Kevin Barry. People stick their heads out windows and tell him, "For Jesus' sake, put a sock in it." Some of us have to get up in the morning for work. Go home and sing your feckin' patriotic songs. He stands in the middle of the lane and tells the world to step outside. He's ready to fight and die for Ireland, which is more than he can say for the men of Limerick who are known the length and breadth of the world for collaborating with the perfidious Saxons. He's pushing in our door and singing, "And if when all a vigil keep, the West's asleep, the West's asleep, alas and well may Erin weep, that Connacht lies in slumber deep. But hark a voice like thunder spake, the West's awake, the West's awake. Sing, oh, hurrah, let England quake. We'll watch till death for Erin's sake." He calls from the bottom of the stairs, "Angela, Angela, is there a drop of tea in this house?" She doesn't answer, and he calls again, "Francis, Malachy, come down here, boys. I have the fried a penny for you." I want to go down and get the fried a penny, but Mam is sobbing with the coat over her mouth, and Malachy says, "I don't want his old fried a penny. He could keep it." Dad is stumbling up the stairs, making a speech about how we all have to die for Ireland. He lights a match and touches it to the candle by Mam's bed. He holds the candle over his head and marches round the room singing. Michael wakes and lets out a loud cry. The Hannons are banging on the wall next door. Mam is telling Dad he's a disgrace, so why doesn't he get out of the house altogether? He stands in the middle of the floor with the candle over his head. He pulls a penny from his pocket and waves it to Malachy and me. "You're fried a penny, boys," he says. "I want you to jump out of that bed and line up here like two soldiers and promise to die for Ireland, and I'll give the two of you the fried a penny." Malachy sits up in the bed. "I don't want it," he says. And I tell him, "I don't want it either." Dad stands for a minute swaying and puts the penny back in his pocket. He turns toward Mam and she says, "You're not sleeping in this bed tonight." He makes his way downstairs with a candle, sleeps on a chair, misses work in the morning, loses the job at the cement factory, and we're back on the dole again. The Master says it's time to prepare for First Confession and First Communion, to know and remember all the questions and answers in the Catechism, to become good Catholics, to know the difference between right and wrong, to die for the faith if called on. The Master says it's a glorious thing to die for the faith, and Dad says it's a glorious thing to die for Ireland. And I wonder if there's anyone in the world who would like us to live. My brothers are dead, and my sister is dead, and I wonder if they died for Ireland or the faith. Dad says they were too young to die for anything. Mam says it was disease and starvation and him never having a job. Dad says, "Ach, Angela," puts on his cap, and goes for a long walk. The Master says we're each to bring threepence for the First Communion Catechism with the green cover. The Catechism has all the questions and answers we have to know by heart before we can receive First Communion. Older boys in the fifth class have the thick Confirmation Catechism with the red cover, and that costs sixpence. I'd love to be big and important and parade around with the red Confirmation Catechism, but I don't think I'll live that long the way I'm expected to die for this or that. I want to ask why there are so many big people who haven't died for Ireland or the faith. But I know if you ask a question like that, you get the thump on the head, or you're told, "Go out and play." It's very handy to have Mikey Malloy living around the corner from me. He's 11. He has fits, and behind his back we call him Molloy the Fit. People in the lane say the fit is an affliction, and now I know what affliction means. Mikey knows everything because he has visions in his fits, and he reads books. He's the expert in the lane on girls' bodies and dirty things in general, and he promises, I'll tell you everything, Frankie, when you're 11 like me and you're not so thick and ignorant. It's a good thing he says Frankie so I'll know he's talking to me, because he has crossed eyes and you never know who he's looking at. If he's talking to Maliki, and I think he's talking to me, he might go into a rage and have a fit that will carry him off. He says it's a gift to have crossed eyes because you're like a god looking two ways at once, and if you had crossed eyes in the ancient Roman times, you had no problem getting a good job. If you look at pictures of Roman emperors, you'll see there's always a great hint of crossed eyes. When he's not having the fit, he sits on the ground at the top of the lane reading the books his father brings home from the Carnegie Library. His mother says, books, books, books. He's ruining his eyes with the reading. He needs an operation to straighten them out, but who'll pay for it? She tells him if he keeps on straining his eyes, they'll float together till he has one eye in the middle of his head. Ever after, his father calls him Cyclops, who is in a Greek story. Nora Molloy knows my mother from the queues at the St. Vincent de Paul Society. She tells Ma'am that Mikey has more sense than 12 men drinking pints in a pub. He knows the names of all the popes from St. Peter to Pius the 11th. He's only 11, but he's a man. Oh, a man indeed. Many a week he saves the family from pure starvation. He borrows a handcart from Aidan Farrell and knocks on doors all over Limerick to see if there are people who want coal or turf delivered, and down the dock road he'll go to haul back great bags 100 weight or more. He'll run messages for all people who can't walk, and if they don't have a penny to give him, a prayer will do. If he earns a little money, he hands it over to his mother, who loves her Mikey. He is her world, her heart's blood, her pulse, and if anything ever happened to him, they might as well stick her in the lunatic asylum and throw away the key. Mikey's father, Peter, is a great champion. He wins bets in the pubs by drinking more pints than anyone. All he has to do is go out to the Jakes, stick his finger down his throat and bring it all up so that he can start another round. Peter is such a champion, he can stand in the Jakes and throw up without using his finger. He's such a champion that could chop off his fingers and he'd carry on regardless. He wins all that money but doesn't bring it home. Sometimes he's like my father and drinks the dole itself. And that's why Nora Molloy is often carted off to the lunatic asylum, demented with worry over her hungry, famishing family. She knows, as long as you're in the asylum, you're safe from the world and its torments. There's nothing you can do. You're protected. And what's the use of worrying? It's well known that all the lunatics in the asylum have to be dragged in, but she's the only one that has to be dragged out, back to her 5 children, and the champion of all pint drinkers. You can tell when Nora Molloy is ready for the asylum, when you see her children running around white with flour from pole to toe. That happens when Peter drinks the dole money and leaves her desperate, and she knows the men will come to take her away. You know she's inside frantic with the baking. She wants to make sure the children won't starve while she's gone, and she roams Limerick begging for flour. She goes to priests, nuns, Protestants, Quakers. She goes to Rank's flour mills and begs for the sweepings from the floor. She bakes day and night. Peter begs her to stop, but she screams, "This is what comes of drinking the dole." He tells her the bread will only go stale. There's no use talking to her. Bake, bake, bake. If she had the money, she'd bake all the flour in Limerick and regions beyond. If the men didn't come from the lunatic asylum to take her away, she'd bake till she fell to the floor. The children stuff themselves with so much bread. People in the lane say they're looking like loaves. Still, the bread goes stale. And Mikey is so bothered by the waste, he talks to a rich woman with a cookbook, and she tells him make bread pudding. He boils the hard bread in water and sour milk, and throws in a cup of sugar, and his brother loves it, even if that's all they have the fortnight their mother is in the lunatic asylum. My father says, "Do they take her away because she's gone mad baking bread, or does she go mad baking bread because they're taking her away?" Nora comes home calm, as if she'd been at the seaside. She always says, "Where's Mikey? Is he alive?" She worries over Mikey because he's not a proper Catholic, and if he had a fit and died, who knows where he might wind up in the next life. He's not a proper Catholic because he could never receive his first communion for fear of getting anything on his tongue that might cause a fit and choke him. The master tried over and over with bits of the Limerick Leader, but Mikey kept spitting them out till the master got into a state and sent him to the priest, who wrote to the bishop, who said, "Don't bother me, handle it yourself." The master sent a note home saying Mikey was to practice receiving communion with his father or mother, but even they couldn't get him to swallow a piece of the Limerick Leader in the shape of a wafer. They even tried a piece of bread shaped like the wafer with bread and jam, and it was no use. The priest tells Mrs. Malloy not to worry. God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform, and surely he has a special purpose for Mikey, fits and all. She says, "Isn't it remarkable he can swallow all kinds of sweets and buns, but if he has to swallow the body of our Lord, he goes into a fit? Isn't that remarkable?" She worries Mikey might have the fit and die and go to hell, if he has any class of sin in his soul, though everyone knows he's an angel out of heaven. Mikey tells her, "God is not going to afflict you with the fit and then boot you into hell on top of it. What kind of a God would do a thing like that?" "Are you sure, Mikey?" "I am. I read it in a book." He sits under the lamppost at the top of the lane and laughs over his first communion day, which was all a cod. He couldn't swallow the wafer, but did that stop his mother from parading him around Limerick in his little black suit for the collection? She said to Mikey, "Well, I'm not lying, so I'm not. I'm only saying to the neighbours, here's Mikey in his first communion suit. That's all I'm saying, mind you. Here's Mikey. If they think you swallowed your first communion, who am I to contradict them and disappoint them?" Mikey's father said, "Don't worry, Cyclops. You have loads of time. Jesus didn't become a proper Catholic till he took the bread and wine at the Last Supper, and he was 33 years of age." Nora Malloy said, "Will you stop calling him Cyclops? He has two eyes in his head, and he's not a Greek." But Mikey's father, champion of all pint drinkers, is like my uncle Pat Keating. He doesn't give a fiddler's fart what the world says, and that's the way I'd like to be myself. Mikey tells me the best thing about First Communion is the collection. Your mother has to get you a new suit somehow so she can show you off to the neighbours and relations, and they give you sweets and money, and you can go to the Lyric Cinema to see Charlie Chaplin. "What about James Cagney?" "Never mind James Cagney. Lot of blather. Charlie Chaplin is your only man. But you have to be with your mother on the collection. The grown-up people of Limerick are not going to be handing out money to every little Tom, Dick and Mick with the First Communion suit that doesn't have his mother with him." Mikey got over 5 shillings on his First Communion day and ate so many sweets and buns he threw up in the Lyric Cinema, and Frank Goggin, the ticket man, kicked him out. He says he didn't care because he had money left over and went to the Savoy Cinema the same day for a pirate film, and ate Cadbury chocolate and drank lemonade till his stomach stuck out a mile. He can't wait for Confirmation Day because you're older, there's another collection, and that brings more money than First Communion. He'll go to the cinema the rest of his life, sit next to girls from lanes and do dirty things like an expert. He loves his mother, but he'll never get married for fear he might have a wife in and out of the lunatic asylum. What's the use of getting married when you can sit in cinemas and do dirty things with girls from lanes who don't care what they do because they already did it with their brothers? If you don't get married, you won't have any children at home, bawling for tea and bread and gasping with the fit and looking in every direction with their eyes. When he's older, he'll go to the pub like his father, drink pints galore, stick the finger down the throat to bring it all up, drink more pints, win the bets, and bring the money home to his mother to keep her from going demented. He says he's not a proper Catholic, which means he's doomed, so he can do anything he bloody well likes. He says, "I'll tell you more when you grow up, Frankie. You're too young now, and you don't know your arse from your elbow." The master, Mr. Benson, is very old. He roars and spits all over us every day. The boys in the front row hope he has no diseases, for it's the spit that carries all the diseases, and he might be spreading consumption right and left. He tells us we have to know the catechism, backwards, forwards, and sideways. We have to know the Ten Commandments, the seven virtues, divine and moral, the seven sacraments, the seven deadly sins. We have to know by heart all the prayers, the Hail Mary, the Our Father, the Confiteor, the Apostles' Creed, the Act of Contrition, the Litany of the Blessed Virgin Mary. We have to know them in Irish and English. And if we forget an Irish word and use English, he goes into a rage and goes at us with the stick. If he had his way, we'd be learning our religion in Latin, the language of the saints who communed intimately with God and his Holy Mother, the language of the early Christians who huddled in the catacombs and went forth to die on rack and sword, who expired in the foaming jaws of the ravenous lion. Irish is fine for patriots, English for traitors and informers, but it's the Latin that gains us entrance to heaven itself. It's the Latin the martyrs prayed in when the barbarians pulled out their nails and cut their skin off inch by inch. He tells us we're a disgrace to Ireland and her long, sad history, that we'd be better off in Africa praying to bush or tree. He tells us we're hopeless, the worst class he ever had for First Communion, but as sure as God made little apples, he'll make Catholics of us. He'll beat the idler out of us and the sanctifying grace into us. Brendan Quigley raises his hand. We call him Question Quigley because he's always asking questions. He can't help himself. "Sir," he says, "what sanctifying grace?" The master rolls his eyes to heaven. He's got to kill Quigley. Instead, he barks at him. "Never mind what sanctifying grace, Quigley. That's none of your business. You're here to learn the catechism and do what you're told. You're not here to be asking questions. There are too many people wandering the world asking questions, and that's what has us in the state we're in. And if I find any boy in this class asking questions, I won't be responsible for what happens. Do you hear me, Quigley?"
"I do."
"I do what?"
"I do, sir."
He goes on with his speech. "There are boys in this class who will never know the sanctifying grace. And why? Because of the greed. I have heard them abroad in the schoolyard talking about First Communion Day, the happiest day of your life. Are they talking about receiving the body and blood of our Lord? Oh, no. Those greedy little blackguards are talking about the money they'll get, the collection. They'll go from house to house in their little suits like beggars for the collection. And will they take any of that money and send it to the little black babies in Africa? Will they think of those little pagans doomed forever for lack of baptism and knowledge of the true faith? Little black babies denied knowledge of the mystical body of Christ? Limbo is packed with little black babies flying around and crying for their mothers, because they'll never be admitted to the ineffable presence of our Lord and the glorious company of saints, martyrs, virgins. Oh, no. It's off to the cinemas our First Communion boys run to wallow in the filth spewed across the world by the devil's henchmen in Hollywood. Isn't that right, McCourt?"
"'Tis, sir."
Question Quigley raises his hand again. There are looks around the room, and we wonder if it's suicide he's after.
What's henchman, sir?
The master's face goes white, then red. His mouth tightens, it opens, and spit flies everywhere. He walks the question and drags him from his seat. He snorts and stutters, and his spit flies around the room. He flogs question across the shoulders, the bottom, the legs. He grabs him by the collar and drags him to the front of the room.
Look at this specimen, he roars.
Question is shaking and crying.
I'm sorry, sir.
The master mocks him.
I'm sorry, sir. What are you sorry for?
I'm sorry I asked the question. I'll never ask a question again, sir.
The day you do, Quigley, will be the day you wish God would take you to his bosom. What will you wish, Quigley?
That God will take me to his bosom, sir.
Go back to your seat, you Amadon, you poltroon, you thing from the far dark corner of a bog.
He sits down with the stick before him on the desk. He tells Question to stop the whimpering and be a man. If he hears a single boy in this class asking foolish questions or talking about the collection again, he'll flog that boy till the blood spurts.
What will I do, boys?
Flog the boy, sir.
Till?
Till the blood spurts, sir.
Now, Clossy, what is the sixth commandment?
Thou shalt not commit adultery.
Thou shalt not commit adultery, what?
Thou shalt not commit adultery, sir.
And what is adultery, Clossy?
Impure thoughts, impure words, impure deeds, sir.
Good, Clossy. You're a good boy. You may be slow and forgetful in the sir department, and you may not have a shoe to your foot, but you're powerful with the sixth commandment, and that will keep you pure.
Paddy Clossy has no shoe to his foot. His mother shaves his head to keep the lice away. His eyes are red. His nose always snotty. The sores on his kneecaps never heal because he picks at the scabs and puts them in his mouth. His clothes are rags he has to share with his six brothers and a sister. And when he comes to school with a bloody nose or a black eye, you know he had a fight over the clothes that morning. He hates school. He's 7 going on 8, the biggest and oldest boy in the class. And he can't wait to grow up and be 14, so that he can run away and pass for 17 and join the English army and go to India where it's nice and warm, and he'll live in a tent with a dark girl with a red dot in her forehead, and he'll be lying there eating figs. That's what they eat in India, figs. And she'll cook the curry day and night and plonk in a ukulele. And when he has enough money, he'll send for the whole family, and they'll all live in the tent, especially his poor father, who's at home coughing up great gobs of blood because of the consumption. When my mother sees Paddy on the street, she says, I wish I'd look at that poor child. He's a skeleton with rags, and if they were making a film about the famine, he'd surely be put in the middle of it. I think Paddy likes me because of the raisin. And I feel a bit guilty because I wasn't that generous in the first place. The master, Mr. Benson, said the government was going to give us the free lunch so we wouldn't have to be going home in the freezing weather. He led us down to a cold room in the dungeons of Leamy School where the charwoman, Nellie Ahern, was handing out the half pint of milk in the raisin bun. The milk was frozen in the bottles, and we had to melt it between our thighs. The boys joked and said the bottles would freeze our things off, and the master roared,
Any more of that talk and I'll warm the bottles on the back of your heads.
We all searched our raisin buns for a raisin, but Nellie said they must have forgotten to put them in, and she'd inquired from the man who delivered. We searched again every day, till at last I found a raisin in my bun and held it up. The boys started grousing and said they wanted a raisin, and Nellie said it wasn't her fault. She'd asked the man again. Now the boys were begging me for the raisin and offering me everything, a slug of their milk, a pencil, a comic book. Toby Mackey said I could have his sister, and Mr. Benson heard him and took him out to the hallway and knocked him around till he howled. I wanted the raisin for myself, but I saw Paddy Clossy standing in the corner with no shoes, and the room was freezing, and he was shivering like a dog that had been kicked. And I always felt sad over kicked dogs. So I walked over and gave Paddy the raisin. because I didn't know what else to do, and all the boys yelled that I was a fool and a feckin' idiot, and I'd regret the day. And after I handed the raisin to Paddy, I longed for it, but it was too late now, because he pushed it right into his mouth and gulped it,